For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're in Mark 13 this evening, a passage that centers on what has been referred to as the Olivet Discourse, or the conversation Jesus had on the Mount of Olives, whichever you prefer. But it all surrounds this issue that I think is sort of an important one. It's the issue about the future. And in some ways, I think people in our culture are obsessed with the question of the future. What does the future hold? What's going to happen? You know, a lot of people sort of feel like we're at this place in civilization, and civilization is no longer just Western. It's global now. We live in this global village, and we have these questions of where is it all going? And we wonder if we're just a runaway freight train heading for some sort of inevitable disaster. Or maybe some of the more optimistic ones among us might think, well, you know, we're really putting it together now. Although, that doesn't seem like the thought of the day isn't really along those optimistic lines. We are really concerned, both as a culture, about where are things going. We really want to know, how does this all work out? We're really interested in this on an individual level, too. We wonder, what about the future of my life? What is the world going to look like for my children? And those are important questions, and they're human questions. They're inevitable questions, especially in a world that seems like it's just in constant flux. It's always changing. And that, in some ways, is new to the technological industrial age. Lives used to be very predictable. I know what my career will be. I know where I'm going to live, what I'm going to do, and so forth. And people just sort of did it. But we are overwhelmed by so many choices, by so many opportunities, by so many things also that are beyond our ability to control, and we just wonder, how do I live with this? And the Bible really speaks to this issue. The Bible has a view of history. The Bible is really all about history. It's all about God's work in history, that God has a plan for history. The history is not just a meaningless sequence of events of just empires rising and empires falling and new empires rising and new empires falling and so forth, but there is a trajectory to history, there's an end point to history, and that occupies the central concern of this passage that we want to look at here tonight. Two parts of this passage. One is where Jesus interacts with the big theme that runs through from chapter 10 through chapter 15 of this book about the temple. And then the second has to do with this idea of where is the future really heading? And these are very related ideas. Let's pick up the story here then in verse 1. It says that Jesus went out of the temple and one of his disciples asked him, "Teacher, behold, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." I don't know where the question is in that. I don't know what he's asking. He's making a point. He's just looking at the Temple of Herod. And he's like, wow, now that is really a marvelous piece of architecture. And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left on another, but all will be torn down." And so here we have this discussion about the temple. And there are two realities that come out of these two verses about the temple. The first is that it really exists as a monument to human pride. This is Israel's third temple now. The previous two have been destroyed. This one's going to be destroyed. This is Herod's temple. Herod was trying to ingratiate himself to the Israelites and was not well-liked because he himself was half Edomite, half Jewish. He knew that his kind of hold on power over the people was pretty tenuous. So he went out and decided, "I'm going to win these people over by having the most awesome looking temple that there ever was." And indeed, the temple of Herod is one of the great architectural wonders of the ancient world. This temple is so large that it could be seen, you know, Jerusalem's sort of up on a hill. And so people traveling miles and miles away would be able to see the mountain on which Jerusalem sits, and would be able also to see this fantastic temple. This temple, in fact, that was so massive, so impressive, as it's engraved with gold and the finest marble and foundation stones that weighed many, many tons. This thing was enormous. It was just this pillar of permanence. It was amazing. And it covered fully 25% of the entire city of Jerusalem. So in some ways, it's a good match for the size, the ego that Herod had. And just everyone was like amazed at this thing. It was just remarkable. The glory of the temple was known to all. It was a source of great pride. On the other hand as well, it was a source of great hypocrisy. And we've been talking about this, haven't we, over the last several weeks, that Jesus has most of his difficult conversations in and around the temple area as certain religious officials are interacting with them. And Jesus goes and he cleanses the temple, upsetting the money changers' tables and all these animals being thrown out and just this anarchy that Jesus creates. He's trying to make the point as sort of as a prophet and very much the spirit of Jeremiah chapter 7 in the Old Testament, that just because God has this temple doesn't mean that we can control him and manipulate him by our religious performances. And that's what the people believed. It had become for them sort of a system, a blind religious thing. You just put in your coin and out comes your acceptance with God. And Jesus was so angry that God was being misrepresented in this way, as it is always the case, of course, in man-made religion. And so he says, no one stone will be left on another. A shocking prediction. This picture of incredible permanence, this pinnacle of human architectural accomplishment, Jesus says, is going to be torn down. And his disciples just must have thought, man, are you daft? Have you lost it? You got to be kidding me. Nothing could be as permanent as a fixture like the temple of Herod. But Jesus said, no, count on it. It's going to happen. And in fact, it does happen. In 70 AD, just a couple decades later, the Jews have an uprising. Titus, the Roman general, decides he's had enough. He sets siege to the city of Jerusalem. He destroys the temple. The Jewish people are scattered all over the place. Oh, yeah, Jesus did predict this, and it did, in fact, happen. And so with this kind of framework in mind, then Jesus is going to begin to set his sights then on other things about the future. But before we get into that, I want to just make an important contrast about the temple, something that Jesus has been teaching us all along. It would be important just to remember that the temple is a symbol of God's mercy. So it may be, in one way, a monument to man's pride and his glory, but in intent, it is a symbol of God's mercy. The point of the temple was, as it said in chapter 11, verse 17, to be a house of prayer for the nations. That God's intent was to bless people by being present and by drawing people to himself. And it's God's intent, it's God's way to leave a blessing to be represented among the peoples of the earth, to bring in peace and reconciliation. And that this imagery of the temple is fulfilled in Christ in two important ways. First, that his body as a sacrifice on the cross fulfills the purpose of the temple. And that's why Jesus makes this point earlier in his ministry. He says, tear down this temple, and in 3 days I'll build it back up again. And his disciples remembered that he had said that, and that he was speaking prophetically about the temple of his body. So what's going on in the temple is that people are offering sacrifices to atone for their sin, to make them acceptable to God. And Jesus is saying, well, that's just all symbolism. Animals can't make you right before God. But when Jesus came and he offered himself as a sacrifice for the sins of humanity, now that's a sacrifice that means something. And so in that sense, Jesus really completes what the whole point of the temple is. And by doing that, then, gives us absolute access to God. One of the cool things that happens Right after Christ breathes his last breath, utters his last word, and all three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, make this point that the curtain in the temple that separates the Holy of Holies, that place where God in a symbolic way dwelled and where all these sacrifices of atonement were to take place, was ripped in half from top to bottom. And what does this mean? It's just simply saying, hey, now that the real payment for sin has been made, everyone has absolute access, unmediated by a priest or anyone else, to God himself through the blood of Christ. So it's an awesome picture. Now let's just go back again then to this reflection then about the prediction of the temples being destroyed. The disciples pick up on this, and it says in verse 3, as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, hey, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all things are going to be fulfilled? They knew that Jesus was speaking of the future, and that that future involved catastrophe for the temple, and potentially catastrophe for their people. And so now Jesus has really got their attention, and they're wondering, what's going to happen? Where's all this stuff going? And that's the question that we ask ourselves. Where is all this stuff going? And so Jesus then answers their question. The future conceived in two realities as well. The first is the real bad news, where humans take the future. God has given to his creatures the capacity to choose for themselves what they will do with the creation that God gave them, with the lives that God gave them, with the assets that God gave them. We are free in that sense, and we are able to chart an independent course, even if that independent course means that we choose to be independent of God himself. God has extended to us that kind of freedom. And where does that exercise of human freedom, where does that go? Well, Jesus is going to go on to describe where that goes as he contemplates the end of history. History is not just an eternal loop, an eternal cycle of just going on and on and on and on. That's Asian religion. That's what they believe, you know, in the great religions of the East. But that's not the biblical view. The biblical view, as you know, starts in Genesis 1, verse 1, with what words? In the beginning. Yes, in the beginning. And that there is a beginning then portends or suggests as well that there will be an end. That's right. And that kind of idea of history being a linear process, a sequence of moments that's leading to some place, that is absolutely fundamental to the biblical view. It's absolutely unique in all religious literature. That is a way of thinking that has completely transformed civilization. You know, think about it. We could not even conceive of language like success, right? Progress. What do these things suggest? What do these words mean? They mean that the future doesn't necessarily is a reflection of the past, that things are changing, that there's possibility for improvement, and all this kind of stuff. And that is just built deeply right into our psyche, right into our DNA. Yes, there is a future. And so we are future-oriented. That's why we're not just the ostrich with our head stuck in the sand. We really believe in the importance of thinking in that long-term way. And so these disciples, they raise this question, when will these signs be fulfilled? And Jesus then is going to describe for them, what are those signs? He's not going to tell them when they're going to be fulfilled for the simple reason that, as he goes on to say, nobody knows, only the Father himself. And so sometimes these discussions about the end of human history are met Well, certainly in our culture, and I'm sure things come to your mind about this, with all kinds of crackpot ideas, predictions about when all these things were going to come to pass. I remember in 1987, moving from Chicago to Columbus, there were people sitting around the table at this Bible study they were at. They were looking at this pamphlet called 87 Reasons for 87, which was all about the 87 reasons that this author had somehow extracted from the Bible to explain why in 1987 Christ was going to come back. I'm understanding now that it's in its 22nd revision. But anyhow, I don't want to get into that whole speculative thing. I think that's not really the point. The point is, where are things going? What can we expect? And Jesus talks about four areas, four signs that he says that anticipate the time of his return and the culmination of human history. And he describes them in the context of what he calls birth pangs. In other words, things that happen, they're not uncommon, but they are happen with, well, what happens when labor gets closer and closer to delivery? They become more frequent and they become more, ladies, intense, kind of like taking your bottom lip and stretching up over your head, as Bill Cosby once said. Birth pangs. What are they? Well, he says first that there will be wars and rumors of wars in verse 7 and the beginning of verse 8. We've always had wars, but as the time of history's completion draws near, the kind of war that is anticipated is on a scale and a frequency never imaginable in previous centuries or eras of a human society. He talks in verses 6, 21, and 22 about the proliferation of deception and where there are these false Christs and false messiahs that will rise up and they will play to people's fears and they will offer them false hopes and lead people down the pathway, you know, into the desert or whatever, which is where God does not want them to go. And so spiritual deception just becomes a huge deal as the sand is working its way out of the hourglass. There is betrayal in verses 9 to 13, where even family members are willing to give family members up for the sake of some kind of a freedom, maybe from oppression or an economic reward or something like that. Well, we've seen that happen. That happens all the time, even in the world today. This happens in China. This happened under the Soviet Union, in Russia, places like that, where people will just betray even family members if it means some sort of advantage for them. And Paul kind of echoes this too as he envisions the end of time, and he says most people's love will grow cold. And so there's that just kind of relationships and the fabric of society itself just being frayed and falling apart. Ecological crisis, famine, Jesus mentions specifically in verse 8, along with earthquakes. And, you know, here, now, these phenomena have always been present, famines, earthquakes, things like that. But now, at such a level, at such catastrophe, that now, you know, not just significant populations, but huge populations of humanity are led to this place where there just simply is not enough food for them to eat. And Jesus says, when we look into the future, that is where things are heading. And then he goes on and he says in verse 19, there will be greater anguish those days than at any time since God created the world. That's a little sobering. And he says, it will never be so great again. In fact, unless the Lord shortens that time of calamity, not a single person will survive. But for the sake of his chosen ones, he has shortened these days. So what is the end of human history? It is so dire, according to Jesus' words, that unless he himself intervened, it would have meant the eradication of all humanity. Humankind is great. Humankind has all kinds of dignity, and what humans are able to engineer and what they are able to accomplish, you know, is mind-boggling. It's extraordinary. I mean, the ability to send people to the moon, to be able to develop the kind of technology that links the entire world together. I have a nephew who lives in Africa. I talk to him on this weird phone thing, and I see him when we're talking. And it costs like a dime a minute. What's that called? Skype. But there's all kinds of stuff like that. It's amazing. Genetic engineering, able to produce new kinds of crops that can grow in all kinds of conditions and meet all kinds of needs. Humanity is great. And the biblical view of humanity is great. We are the image of God. There's something wonderful about who He has made. But there is also something deeply, tragically, and terminally wrong with humanity. And we are in rebellion against our Creator. And so all of the greatness, all of the potential, all of the capacity that human beings have is turned in on ourselves. And because it's turned in on ourselves, never is able to be applied beyond the moral limitations of our own character and our own spiritual state. So in that sense, history is simply the expression out in the real world of the condition of the human heart. Boy, this is something that thinking people have pondered for a really long time. And I was reading, this is many years ago, the scientist Jacob Bronowski began to reflect on this. He was involved in trying to rebuild Japan at the end of the Second World War. He was one of the first people on the ground at Nagasaki to see the destruction there. And here are his comments. He said, "The power of science for good and for evil has troubled other minds than ours. We are not here fumbling with a new dilemma. Our subject and our fears are as old as the tool-making civilizations. Men have been killed with weapons before. What happened at Nagasaki was more massive. 40,000 people killed in an instant. More ironic, bombs exploding mainly over the Christian community in Japan." And then he says, "Nothing happened in 1945 except that we exchanged the scale of our indifference to man in conscience through revenge for an instant became immediate to us. And before this immediacy fades in a sequence of televised atomic tests, let's acknowledge our subject for what it is. Civilization, face to face with its own implications." And Bronowski is making a very important point. He's saying there's nothing that has changed in the heart of humanity through the development of all of our technology, all of our accumulated wisdom and capacities. That hasn't changed what's inside. And so what that has made us, therefore, is a far more dangerous a factor in creation, with the capacity to obliterate our own earth and ourselves. And this is something Bronowski was just mortified by and horrified by, not just the theoretical possibility that somehow this might happen, but by being witness to the first volley in this process. Yes, man is great. Man has enormous dignity. But there is a problem so catastrophic within the heart of man that no knowledge, no technology, no science, no economic conditions, nothing can change the depths of the danger that is humankind. And Jesus, in speaking in the broad counsel of the Bible, both Old Testament and New, says there will be an end. There will be an end because man's way is not God's way. And when you have a universe, a world populated by over 6 billion people who all answer to themselves, I answer to me, I'm the source of my own truth, I'm the source of my own goodness, it's all about me at the end of the day, this is catastrophe. That's where it's going, folks. That's where the world is headed. And I think it's just important for us, you know, whether it's in our lifetime or our children's lifetime or whenever it might be, that we wise up, that we engage with ourselves over this question, indeed, where is it all going? Because where it's all going, folks, has huge implications for how do I live my life now. Do you see that? You know, how many of us would have been one of those people on the Titanic who, after, you know, the iceberg is hit and the water is coming in and the captain says we're going down, would then get out their bucket of paint and start putting pinstripes on the sides? Well, that's just kind of stupid. But I wonder if that isn't just exactly the kind of thing that we find ourselves consumed by. Well, we'll get back to that a little bit later. Let's think about this. That's the trajectory of history. That is one reality of history. Jesus then introduces another one. He says, unless the days were shortened, that time of calamity, not a single person would survive. But in verse 24, in those days is the word that's used. In those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will shake. And this is where God gets involved in the future. God is willing to allow human beings the freedom to go out there, do their thing, and see where it leads. But he also is a sovereign God who's going to stand in. He's not going to allow mankind to just obliterate ourselves. And so here Jesus is using the imagery really taken in the Old Testament book of Joel chapter 2 that discusses the day of the Lord, or those days, that time when God stops allowing humankind to make history go the direction that we choose for it to go, but he intervenes, and now he is going to do some things. And the first thing that he does is he moves in judgment. And that's what this language is. The sun will be darkened and the moon will give no light. In the context of where Jesus is taking this in Joel chapter 2, and there are parallels in Isaiah chapter 13 and in other places as well, what he's saying is that, and he's using language that's sometimes called apocalyptic. You know, it's cosmic. It's like, oh, the whole universe is about to collapse. The heavens themselves are shaking. The sun is dark. The moon can't give light. You know, the most fundamental things. It's like, you know, it's like turning off your TV and the screen just goes blank. And he's like, that is what I'm talking about. When God returns to intervene in human history, he comes and he intervenes with justice. And it is apocalyptic. The sovereign, holy Lord of the universe returns to a rebel creation out of the place of self-extermination. And he says, stop! And he compels that every knee will bow to him and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is the Lord to the glory of the Father. That's where this is heading. An end to human autonomy and human autonomous rule. The Bible says that we are accountable to God. You know, He's given us freedom. But at the end of the day, there is a time where we will account to Him for our lives, for how we've participated in the train wreck that is human history. And He will call us into account. And He must call us to account. Because if God does not enforce His justice, then He becomes a co-collaborator in our own suffering and our own injustice. But God's justice will stand. And man, what a bizarrely unpopular thing to think about here. I see you all very quiet. Just kind of, because what we want is something that is soothing and something that, you know, makes me feel good about where I am and what I want. You know, tell me I've been good. Tell me I'm okay. And God loves you enough to tell you the truth. That if you do not know Jesus Christ in a personal way, if you have not responded to His substitutionary death for you by faith, saying, I want that death to apply to me. I want His payment for sin to be the covering for my sin. Then we do stand before Him in our own guilt and therefore under His judgment. And that's the reality. But there's another reality as well. You know, this imagery of judgment, the sun becoming dark, the moon no longer emitting light. You know, it's very interesting that Jesus entered into this darkness for us. And all that represents, that language of judgment, He entered into that for us. And so when He is hanging on the cross, all of the gospel writers agree on this point. They said, when the sixth hour came, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. Darkness. Just what He's describing here about the judgment of the end time. And what all of the gospel writers are saying is that Jesus experienced the judgment of God in His cross. All of our guilt, yours and mine, all of the filth that is human history, these all fell upon Him. And in a moment in time, He absorbed, He took on the wrath of God for all of the sins of humanity. And it was dark. And Jesus chose to enter into that darkness. Because He loves you. Because God loves you. Because God will not stop being God in the light of His love for you. Justice must be served. But God does love you, and He has demonstrated His love because He has entered into the judgment of God for you. And so the gospel, the good news, is simply that with our sin paid for, the offer of forgiveness on the table, He is inviting us to simply say, yeah, that's what I want. I want to be right before God because of what Jesus did for me. And that's a decision that we have to make. No one can make it for you. We're not born into this. No one can pronounce a formula over you to make it so. Jesus has declared it, and you must receive it. And that is the utter crossroads between time and eternity for you. Have you made that decision? here tonight? Have you just, in the quiet of your heart, said, I understand, Christ, what you did for me on the cross. I thank you for that. And now I'm asking you, make that payment that you gave for sin account for my sin. And that's all God is asking us to do. Now, there may be some pushback in your heart. It sounds a little too easy. Oh, yeah, is it? How come you haven't done it then? Okay, it's because you're prideful. That's why. You don't want something that's just given to you as a gift. You want to earn it. Well, you can't earn this. So I urge you, humble yourself before God and receive what you cannot earn. Let's just press on a little bit further here. In verse 26, it says, then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, and he will send forth his angels and will gather his chosen people from the four winds, from the farthest ends of the earth to the farthest ends of heaven. And so this ends up being pretty good news here, actually. So we have a God who is willing and will judge. And the end of history ends in judgment, but it also ends in great blessing. The Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory, gathering his people from all over the world together. This is the blessings for humanity under the description of the Son of Man, description of the Messiah in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, as the Messiah comes to rule on the earth, to subordinate all powers to his authority, not for the purpose of just dominating, but for the purpose then of extending blessing as far as his sovereignty reaches through King Messiah. That is God's intent. That is what's going to happen. And it brings us then to a couple of conclusions that I think we really need to ponder together here this evening. First, there's a sense of urgency in Jesus' language. You know, you don't talk about the near extermination of the human race in a flat monotone voice. Okay? That's a big deal, isn't it? Of course it is. And Jesus speaks with real urgency here. Urgency that where you place your hope really matters. It really matters. And if you're just building your hope on sand, no matter how nice that house might look, hey man, this tsunami of all tsunamis is coming, that house is going down. Where will you place your hopes? What are you building for? What is the future you're seeking? That is a big question for us. What are you relying on? Where do you think this is all going? And you know, Christians have a very urgent task. Jesus says here in verse 10 that he will not return until all of the nations have followers of him. And so there is an urgency in the Christian community. We do know how this all ends. And God is calling on us to get out with that message and to share with Bhutanese refugees, with people in Haiti, with people across the street, with people around the world. This is urgent business, folks. The author of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27, he says, it is appointed for a man to live once, and after that comes his judgment. And we've got a message about that that is really good news, that no one has to experience the judgment of God. And so if the love of God that we have found in Christ compels us and controls us and presses us forward, it presses us forward in conversation, in honest exploration of what is the truth. knowing that truth is not just some abstract artwork or something like that, but it is absolutely the core of what everything is really all about. Everything stands on this. You know, if Christ was wrong about this, who cares? From dust we came, to dust we shall return. But what if he's right? Oh, everything's on the table. There's an urgency that God calls us to. An urgency to move toward our neighbor, to pray for open doors where we can share this wonderful message that God has sent our way. And then a very parallel idea along with urgency is alertness. Four times in the text, Jesus calls his people to be alert, to be alert, to be alert, to be alert. So that must matter to him. Of course it does. Because we live in a world that dulls us to sleep. Well, I'm safe. I'm comfortable. I don't really see that there's really much at stake. I was visiting a church about a year ago now, and we were having these discussions. I was invited in. We had these seminars. One of the head guys there, he says, there are no urgent matters in this church. I'm like, really? Really? And I think that that's characteristic of the American church, although this was not an American church. This is a church in Asia. That there are no urgent matters, that we just kind of do our thing. Sort of when we get around to it, God fits into a fairly comfortable compartment in our life. And we're good with that. We're cool with that. And Jesus is calling us to an alertness, not to be deluded, not to be put to sleep, not to forget how does this whole train wreck work out. But to be his person at that place and at that time where we can do some good, where we can represent him, where we can draw people's focus on the real reality that drives history, which is the sovereign Lord of the universe. And that alertness, you know, that produces a certain sort of spiritual vitality, an ability to see this is where God's at work now, and to follow him and to sense his activity. And I think sometimes we look around, we're like, well, maybe I'm like this guy that Lev was talking about. He said there's no urgent matters around here. Maybe you're wrong about that. Maybe there's all kinds of urgency and you are asleep. And we do. We have problems in our groups, problems with folks here tonight, problems in my own life as I struggle here as well. To just kind of feel like there's nothing really at stake. And Jesus is saying everything is at stake. And when we are willing to believe him, then we are able to see the world through his lens. We find ourselves being led by him into useful, effective venues of Christian witness. And that is, in a general sense, the message of Mark chapter 13. And it's a philosophy of history. It's a reality about history. And we just, God is calling on us folks, all of us here tonight, regardless of where you are with him, to connect the dots. If this is where history's going, where am I going? If this is what history is about, what am I about? And when we begin to agree with God and we begin with a sense of urgency and alertness to move towards the things of God, well, this is going to rock our world. It's going to put us really in a sharp contrast with the riptide that is this culture that is moving in this direction. And it's difficult. That's why the body of Christ is so necessary to stand together against these influences. But as we do that, we experience something beautiful, which is a foretaste of what the end of history will bring in the rule of God on this earth. He is the living head of the church. So there you go.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.